I'm John Bridgeland of Civic Enterprises and co-chair with Harris Wofford of an inspirational new effort called Service World. And when I told Harris that he's going to close this out, that he had 4 to 5 minutes, he said, only 45 minutes? So Harris has 40 years in this space and could literally give us wisdom over those four decades. This is more like a family reunion as I look out at the people in the audience. It's been such a privilege to work for the last 18 months on this effort called Service World. And today it's being formally launched here at the Brookings Institution, which I think is so appropriate because it was Lex Rifle. Lex, are you here? And if he's not physically here, he's here in spirit. Launched an effort to look at the role of international volunteer service and strengthening in our world and to analyze various existing programs like the Peace Corps, but also the role of institutions, as Amanda said so eloquently, that preceded the development of the Peace Corps and then carried on by David Caprera here at Brookings and others, really led to this effort over the last 18 months to develop, bring together a lot of the minds and hearts in this audience to bring together some of the compelling ideas for how, as Harris has said, we could take a quantum leap in international volunteer service. Some might think in this environment that's difficult to do. 2.5 years ago, armed with good data, and I don't know about you, but when a panel stands up here and somebody like Amanda and the others say, we've got 38 indicators, we've got generalized linear mixed modeling, that gives me a lot of comfort that we have a more sophisticated effort than we've ever had to show the impact not only on eventually on the underlying problems we're trying to address, but on host countries and then in turn on the volunteers themselves, which can lead to what John Kennedy talked about, a more informed foreign policy. But armed with new data generated domestically, we took that into Ted Kennedy and Orrin Hatch and brought together this wonderful consortium called Service Nation, and which led to the development and passage of the Edward M. Kennedy Serve America Act, which really is the quantum leap in national and community service and across so many programs and so many efforts. So based on that model, we brought together great minds in the international space to convene this group that's now become Service World, launching it here today at Brookings. It's a unique moment in history. It's, as you all know, the 50th anniversary of the announcement of the Peace Corps. Many of us will be with our candles, 2 a.m., October 14th, on the steps of the University of Michigan. We didn't get to participate the first time around. Anybody there, by the way? 2 a.m., October 14th, 1960? No. Well, you're all invited. We'll be there standing on the steps to mark this wonderful occasion, and then the 50th anniversary of the implementation of the Peace Corps. So appropriately, this coalition has come together around what we hope will be called the Sergeant Shriver International Service Act, created and enacted in his name to honor such a wonderful legacy that Harris experienced firsthand when he helped Sarge build and co-found the Peace Corps. The plan is also we have a president who's talked so compellingly in Cairo and elsewhere about the power of interfaith service, bringing Muslims and Christians together to combat and tackle common challenges like malaria. We have a Secretary of State whose major speech on global development ended with this beautifully articulated ringing call of action of how we need to mobilize nurses and doctors and engineers and agronomists and our talent to tackle great global challenges and to develop an emerging leaders in this next generation. Members of Congress on both sides of the aisle right after 9/11, one of the first people to come see me was Senator Lamar Alexander, who talked compellingly about an AIDS Corps. He had just been in Africa and saw the power of expert professional volunteers working side by side in countries around the globe. And out of it came an initiative called Volunteers for Prosperity. And then thousands of Americans, the most active generation called the millennials, that really are outpacing the greatest generation, or at least keeping pace with the greatest generation, in terms of their civic habits, and 78 million baby boomers who are anxious to also serve abroad. Harris will talk later about our goal, which is to formally engage, with some support from government, of 100,000 Americans serving abroad, which was John Kennedy's dream. That would be 1 million over a decade, and then the numbers of additional volunteers they leverage with real impact in global health and education, conservation of resources, and many other issues, showing the power of service not only to transform lives but to have an impact directly on problem solving. Our plan is guided by some principles. First, partnership, not paternalism. Barbara Bush has just started this global health course. She talked about it on a Fox Sunday show the other week. And Americans not just serving in Rwanda, but Rwandans and Americans serving side by side in Boston. When I spent a number of weeks in Rwanda, I learned so much about accountability in terms of how their systems work that I'm bringing back to the United States and educating mayors about. So powerful lessons from abroad that need to be brought to the United States. Second, enabling more millennials and boomers to serve, encouraging interface service like we're seeing in Nigeria today. The Sultan of Sokoto, representing 70 million Muslims, working side by side with the Archbishop of Abuja, 70 million Christians, to combat malaria and foster peace and understanding. Stretch existing government dollars further with the talents of our people. Nothing could be more important in this environment. I noted 84% a positive rating of Americans, although it sounds like we need to take more vacations. We're too hardworking. But that when you think about the impact of people, if you were to take a survey or a sampling of how people view American foreign policy or our policies and compare that to how they view Americans and how the impact that American volunteers can have in terms of favorability, it can have a significant impact. Our service world plan, just very quickly, proposes to expand, strengthen, make more efficient and cost-efficient the Peace Corps, to get it back up to Sergeant Shriver's levels in 1966 of about 15,000 Americans serving abroad, and to solicit more ideas from people like Kevin Quigley and the National Peace Corps Association and others about how we can strengthen and reform and improve the Peace Corps. Expanding after 9/11, working with Colin Powell, we created something called Volunteers for Prosperity. It will expand this model to about 75,000 volunteers. These are skilled Americans who go over and serve for flexible term assignments, working on issues that Congress is already funding in the billions of dollars, like HIV/AIDS, malaria, water for the poor, and seeing Congress, hopefully having Congress view as a central strategy, human capital that will be deployed side by side with these efforts. Creating global service fellowships that will take the model of members of Congress who are now nominating from the military academy, people who will go on to the military academies, giving members of Congress a stake in appointing people from their districts and states to serve for a year abroad as global service fellows, and then hearing directly back to policymakers the impact, both in terms of what our foreign policy should be to what the impact the volunteer could have on problem solving. To ignite more innovative solutions through an international social innovation fund, building on the domestic social innovation fund. President Obama has trumpeted and gotten $50 million for to spark innovations like SMS text technology to save lives from malaria. I want to offer a special thanks to our presenters who've done so much to help us develop these ideas and support our work. Henry Lozano and the Xin Yuen Foundation that has such reach throughout the world, Barb Quaintance and Tom Nelson of the AARP, Steve Rosenthal of Cross Cultural Solutions, and our conveners, the Building Bridges Coalition, Civic Enterprises, Global Peace Service Alliance, International Volunteering Project of Brookings, National Peace Corps Association, Points of Light Institute, and Service Nation. We have an extraordinary panel with us today. The first, I call him the Michael Jordan of corporate civic engagement, Stanley Litow. He's really an extraordinary individual with, wait till you hear about his reach. He's IBM's Vice President of Corporate Citizenship and Corporate Affairs and President of IBM's Foundation. Understand, IBM's on-demand community provides more than 130,000 IBM employees and retirees in more than 68 countries the tools and technologies to help nonprofits and schools meet pressing needs. IBM has developed innovative voice recognition technology to help non-literate children and adults learn to read, automatic language translation and bilingual email, a humanitarian grid to power research on cancer and AIDS, and new digital imaging technology to improve water quality. He helped devise IBM's Global Citizens Portfolio consisting of matching accounts for learning, and the Corporate Service Corps, a corporate version of the Peace Corps that trains thousands of IBM's future leaders. IBM has also been a leader in Service World. Second, we have Steve Rosenthal, who's chairman of the Building Bridges Coalition and founder and executive director of Cross-Cultural Solutions, which places 4,000 volunteers, about half the Peace Corps number, abroad every year. He is development chief for the traditional area of Ziavi, Ghana, the only non-African ever to have been given this honor. He is a co-convener of Service World and has mobilized hundreds of organizations to support it. He is also the grassroots movement builder behind the Service World effort. And finally, that transformational leader, Michelle Nunn, who's CEO of the Points of Light Institute, although a lot of us are a little nervous that she's here, given that she's running this 6,000-person conference next Monday through Wednesday in New York. But I guess that means she has it in hand. She's the CEO of the Points of Light Institute and the founder of the Hands-On Network, a co-convener of Service Nation, which led to the passage of the Kennedy Serve America Act, studied at Oxford in India and Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and is perennially ranked in the top 50 most powerful nonprofit executives in the United States, and is a co-convener of Service World. So please just welcome them warmly. So Stan, tell us about IBM's Corporate Service Corps, how it's integral to your business strategy, what public-private partnerships you have underway that advance it more broadly beyond IBM, and highlight any innovative practices that are transforming how we think about the relationship between the private sector and international volunteer service.
Okay, Bridge, thank you very much. The Michael Jordan, huh?
You better live up to it.
I left my hook shot at home. The Corporate Service Corps, while we describe it sometimes as a corporate version of the Peace Corps, it has many components to it that are really about business strategy and scalable strategy for a company like IBM. We're a big company. We have 420,000 employees. It's a $100 billion company. We do business in 170 different countries. And what is strategically vital for a big company is to have high-quality leadership development. And while we as a company spend $600 million a year on education and training for our employees and spend a lot of money on international assignments, those programs, while they cost a lot of money, weren't about the high-quality leadership development that's going to take a company like ours into the 21st century. So we, working with a lot of collaborators, many NGOs like CDS, which is in the room, Digital Opportunities Trusts and others, we developed a program that would offer our employees, the top high-achieving employees in the company, emerging leaders who are likely going to lead a company like IBM into the 21st century, to give them an opportunity to participate in global team assignments to make a difference in the developing world. So for about 500 people who get selected a year, we have about 8,000 applications. It's a highly selective program. People have to be really high performers. It's not about just sending people from the U.S. Only about 25% of the participants in the program come from the U.S. These are global teams. 10 people going to Nigeria, and the project was to begin the process of setting up a social safety net program in Cross River Province. They delivered high-quality business consulting service. If it were billable, it would be about a $250,000 piece of work. So in a year, the value of the work is about $14 million. Now, we have our own research on the program as well. We can share with the researchers. What we've been able to demonstrate is that people gain significant amount of skills, teaming skills, cultural adaptability skills that are vital to be a leader in a company like IBM. So what we got out of it was highly trained global leaders. We also did some research on what they were able to develop for their partners in the field. For example, in Ho Chi Minh City, They delivered a roadmap to make the city smarter, including a program around food and supply chain issues, transportation issues, energy and health care. So what gets delivered is high-quality work because the teams consist of the absolute best of the best that we have. So, for example, that team in Ho Chi Minh City had the director of IBM's research laboratory in India on the team. So they're the best finance people, the best legal people, the best software developers, high technology people, marketing people, communications people. Their assignment is 1 month living together basically 24/7 on the ground, but they spend 2.5 months before they go, setting their project up, building their project, and then they spend 2.5 months after they come back, essentially mentoring the next team that goes in. I was interested in the research on the degree to which people have sustainable relationships, because we now have in this 2.5 year period about 1,000 people who have been through this program, and they never leave it because they work on it all the time, collaborating online. They have the best strategies. They develop the training programs, and they built a network of people that are vitally important to the company. We describe it often as a triple benefit program. The benefit to the individual is it's how they become leaders in a global company. The benefit on the ground to people is they get the benefit of the absolute best business consulting services, and they don't pay anything for it. The benefit for IBM is it opens up global markets. It's sustainable. It is not something in the year. In the first year, we identified this as a program that would be 200 people a year, and we've now scaled it up to 500 a year, and my guess is it's going to go larger than that. You know, business has a lot of self-interest in developing global leaders. If you look at IBM as one of the Fortune 500 companies, making a commitment to do about 1,500 people over a 3-year period through a program like this, we're doing it because it's good for IBM's business to do it. People do deliver the kind of real services on the ground, but it's sustainable because it's not the spare change approach, it's the real change approach. Now imagine if 100 companies did a half of what we did, you'd have 75,000 people involved over a 3-year period. What if Fortune 500 companies, all of them did half of what we did, you would in spades make the goal that you have for your service nation, and you wouldn't be tapping into government dollars to do it. You could save the government dollars to support the NGOs, the people on the ground, the second stage development, local government activities, because you'd be tapping into what is a strategic imperative for global companies as they operate in the 21st century. So I started my career in government. I worked in the mayor's office. I was deputy chancellor of schools. Actually, my first job in government for the mayor was setting up an urban corps modeled after the Peace Corps, which had 10,000 students working in New York City government, and there were programs like it all around the United States, and they accessed college work study money. That's what government can do. They can model the Peace Corps in cities and states around the U.S. And then I had a career in the not-for-profit world, and many of my colleagues in NGOs know that there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of creativity because the United States has a huge reservoir of not-for-profit organizations. There are, in the human services area alone, 900,000 of them just in the U.S. with combined budgets of $1.4 trillion. So they have a great contribution, the CDSs and others, to make a difference in international volunteerism. But corporations have a huge, huge stake in this game. And don't forget it, because we're not forgetting it. And if we're going to build the kind of sustainable solutions bridge that you talked about and that are so, so important, we can't talk about this one sector alone. You know, government has a role, non-governmental organizations have a role, and corporations have a role. Everybody's got a little bit of self-interest, absolutely. But when you understand that and can walk in people's shoes, you can build the sustainable partnerships that really make sense. And don't leave all that resource, all that skill, and all that talent on the table and think about this as something where we've got to raise a huge amount of money and we can't sustain this without the resource. If it is connected to business strategy, if it's a sustainable and scalable activity in the private sector, you're going to be able to access an enormous amount of skill and ability that the private sector brings to the table. Now, in terms of research and benefit from our standpoint now, it's critical to our recruitment efforts. It's how we obtain the best talent, and it's critical in our retention efforts. In the research that another higher education institution did on the Corporate Service Corps, Harvard, they interviewed our participants in the program, the best of the best, the people we don't want to lose, and they asked them, to what extent does this increase your likelihood of completing your career at IBM? And 100% said yes. So from an economic standpoint, that's so critically important to us. So I hope I answered all the questions that you asked, and I'm delighted to answer questions from people in the audience.
That's wonderful. Let me just press you on one point, which is we're here at Brookings. A lot of interest in the relationship between business and government in terms of policy or the platform that government has. And you've articulated so beautifully the enlightened self-interest of IBM in prosecuting this fantastic agenda, which I think is so smart because it's integral to your business strategy. You'll do it. You'll sustain it. You'll invest in it. But what is the relation? What would you want to say to USAID or the State Department or the White House in terms of getting the other Fortune 500 companies to do the same? And tell us a little bit about these international volunteering hubs that are emerging.
Well, we have been working very, very closely with USAID. Several people have mentioned the President's Cairo speech. We work with USAID in initiating an electronic town hall meeting. We call it a JAM. Cooperatively with USAID so that 10,000 people could help set the agenda for the Entrepreneurship Summit. We want to do a similar kind of thing involving service, and we'd like all of you to help participate in that effort. But we've worked very, very closely with USAID, and I think that the goal of a government agency like USAID is to look at this model, and we're not the only one. There are other companies that are leading in this area as well, to create the infrastructure, perhaps through partnership and funding of non-governmental organizations, to provide for all companies the kinds of things that we're funding on our own. So a company wouldn't have to provide 500 people a year. They could provide 5 or 6 or 10, and an NGO could link them together. We will give them the training materials, the computer platform, all the stuff that we've developed for our program. It's not proprietary, and you could extend this with the cooperation of NGOs and the cooperation of government agencies like USAID and government agencies outside the U.S., because this isn't only about what the United States can do. People are interested in this on a worldwide basis, and I think it is absolutely achievable to meet the goals that you and Harris and the leaders of this movement have laid out by accessing all the resources that are available. I think the collaboration and partnership is key, and learning from one another to be able to take it to the next level.
I want to thank Dan and Diane Mealy for their work on Service World. This is just sort of the launch of the initial plan. We want it continually informed, and we're hoping that the corporate sector will come forward even more significantly with ideas to inform the plan. Now, Steve Rosenthal. A lot has changed since the emergence of the Peace Corps in the 1960s in terms of how the international volunteer service field functions and what it looks like. Could you tell us a little bit about how the service movement has changed and evolved, and then how Service World and your efforts through building bridges and cross-cultural solutions has taken advantage of these new trends and opportunities?
With great pleasure, Bridge. Thank you very much. And it's just thrilling to be here as well. And I want to start off by just applauding IBM. The program that you just heard about is truly a visionary program. When we first heard of the creation of it, just the idea, we were all so invested in seeing it become successful, and it's been more successful than we ever could have hoped. As Stan mentioned, the original hope was 200 a year, and now in first 2 years, they've sent over 1,000. I mean, it's incredible, and they really are in a league by themselves. And that's not to say, you know, as I'm sure Stan would echo, that that it's a competitive spirit. No, it's quite the opposite. It's a demonstration of what can be done in this open source fashion that Stan has so generously embodied and communicated, that we seek for this program to be a beacon for other corporations. And there is tremendous, tremendous opportunity for change. We heard about it in the earlier panel about how the economy is the huge mover of change. And if we can tap into the larger forces, that there's tremendous potential. So I want to reiterate Bridge's question of how do we take this and move it to broader corporate engagement, and I hope that the two of you, and in conjunction with all of us, can make that happen. Bridge had asked the question about what has the last 50 years looked like for our field, and although I haven't been around for all of it, I can say that since the creation of the Peace Corps, a whole new explosion of alternatives to the Peace Corps have developed. We're calling it, or it's widely known, I think, at this point, as Global Service 2.0. Whereas in the early days, Peace Corps was the primary opportunity. There were certainly others that the Peace Corps were even based on. But since then, there's become hundreds of alternatives to serving in the Peace Corps. There are opportunities for people that have skilled backgrounds to volunteer and unskilled backgrounds. There's opportunities for young people. The baby boomers are a huge demographic that is not only volunteering but is promising to be one of the big movers of the needle of international volunteering. So it's all ages, it's all backgrounds, it's all durations. We're seeing that not only is the 27-month Peace Corps model very effective, but there's one-month programs. There's one-week programs. Stan's program is a month. Is that right? A month. And look what's able to be accomplished. So there are a myriad of ways for people to serve, but there's a problem. And that is, as Senator Wofford has communicated to us so well, President Kennedy's initial vision was for the Peace Corps to grow to be 100,000 strong. And you'll hear later from Senator Wofford more about this. But right now, the field as a whole, we know the Peace Corps is at a certain level. As a whole, the field is at about 60,000. So the question is, what can we do to get to that 100,000 number? And the answer is quite simple. Bridge is holding it in his lap, and it's literally the Service World Policy Platform. It really is that simple. There are so many opportunities for people to serve, and the problem is literally money. Right now, the government is able to pay for the Peace Corps volunteers, who number 8,000 now, perhaps, in that area. And for the other 50,000 plus, they're basically paying their own way. And the fees that they pay support the organizations that send them. And the barrier is funding. And we're not talking about a lot of money. We're talking about, in relative terms to the numbers we've heard today in the billions, we're talking about a tiny fraction of percents here to take us from the 60,000 to the 100,000. And these are proven programs by the generalized linear mixed modeling, which I also noted, Bridge, and regression models as well, which is very reassuring. But, you know, things that we all know to be truths, as those that are, you know, I'm very confident that most, if not all, people here are former international volunteers. We know these things to be true, but we need this important research. And so the Service World Platform is just a rifle shot, extremely effective and low-cost model for ramping up what might be one of the most important things this country can do today to address the challenges that we have. I mean, we heard that the Obama administration's number one challenge that they challenge was the image of America overseas. International volunteering addresses that directly. We look at other challenges like building bridges of understanding across cultures? What's more important in today's world, especially after 9/11? Think about what might have been if we had millions serving, building these bridges before that. International volunteering builds those bridges, and we've heard so many examples today addressing critical global issues like poverty, education, health, and community development. None of us are asserting that international volunteering is the development mechanism, far from it, but it's a very important component of it, irreplaceable, as a matter of fact. And international volunteering is pivotal in addressing our nation's and our world's challenges. It builds this next generation of leaders. We've got wonderful programs that are building leaders that return from these programs, not only young people, but also corporate citizens that have increased cultural competency. I know I'm delving into the preaching to the choir part that we all know, but it's just so clear that there are such tremendous things that this legislation can address quite easily. It's such a powerful platform, and we're going to hear more about it. Other important areas are building a activated constituency to build a sophisticated foreign policy. Think about how much more informed people are, and the research has illustrated when volunteers return from their service and their personal transformation and their career changes. It even ties so beautifully, and one of the themes that we heard today is our time is now. We really are at a historic moment in terms of our field and how relevant it is to today's challenges, and our time is now. And one of the things that really rings true about where we are today as a field and where our nation's priority is and where the world is heading as a whole is there's a philosophy of engaging with each other as peers, international engagement with a spirit of respect, and that is what the best international volunteers embody as well. Service World Platform calls it partnership, not paternalism. How many times do we hear partnership today? So that spirit of respect that we've heard so often in terms of our new foreign policy is again embodied in international volunteering. We heard Ambassador Bagley so eloquently speak today about how government-to-government activity is very important in charting our world's positive future, but it's the citizen diplomacy, it's the people-to-people grassroots interaction that's critical to complement this, and that, again, is international volunteering at its finest when you look at citizen diplomacy. You look at volunteers also, they build a better world by helping focus on what brings us all together, all different people, in terms of focusing on our similarities and not our differences. I think that what volunteers and people in host countries around the world come away learning is that we're all the same. There might be different languages or cultures, but we all care about our kids and our safety and our access to health care. And it's one of the great lessons that people take back from this, that what binds us together is what we share in common and not what our differences are. Let's define our policies and our solutions to our problems by working together around our similarities. Again, exactly what international volunteers do day in and day out. And so I really feel that this is a unprecedented opportunity that we have now. The Service World legislation promises to be, when it becomes a reality, promises to be one of the greatest single advances in our field since the creation of the Peace Corps. We will see the funding of tens of thousands of people who cannot currently afford to volunteer, that we will see a much increased number of volunteers or volunteering overseas. And not only that, but through the Social Innovation Fund, which is a component of this, we're going to see a focus on improving quality and improving impacts in country. This is very well thought out legislation that has been developed through proposed legislation that's been developed from the input of the field, from the practitioners, from the volunteers. It's been many years in the making, and I am just so confident in this. I also feel like in comparison to the other problems that our nation is facing and taking on with billions of dollars and debating about the potential good and level of impact, this should be one of our first moves. This should be easy. Talking about the amount of money and the amount of positive impact that we have, we can do this. And I know that everyone in this room, as I look around, if the people in this room can't move the needle on international service, I don't know who can. I mean, I am so pleased that we have such a strong coalition and such a strong team. I am so confident that if we all be very active over the course of these coming months and probably years, that we will support Service World proposed legislation and watch it become a reality and watch really wonderful, tremendous things happen. And I think we'll look back very proud. So I urge everyone to I don't want to say join us because we've all been working together for so long, but you know, let's really keep the pressure on and welcome to some of the new and very powerful partners who have joined us, and tremendous appreciation to John Bridgeland, who's helped shape this legislation. John, have I addressed the question?
That's perfect. Thank you, Steve. Kevin acknowledged all the former Peace Corps volunteers. Could you just raise your hand if you started, founded, or volunteered through one of these NGOs or other organizations that have flourished since the creation of the Peace Corps? How many in the room? Yeah. Wonderful.
Let's give them big hand.
Big hand. Well done. Michelle Nunn, you have ignited hands-on networks in communities across the United States in areas like in the aftermath of Katrina and New Orleans and other places that had a profound effect on meeting challenges domestically. You've also spearheaded the development of the Volunteer Generation Fund in the Kennedy Serve America Act that will unleash, again, tens of thousands of volunteers across our country to join these networks. What does a hands-on network points of light vision look like in communities around the world in terms of furthering this international volunteer service movement?
Thanks, Bridge, and thanks for your terrific leadership. It's wonderful to be with this, this whole room of real innovative entrepreneurs who are changing the face of international service. A couple of reflections. I actually think that as we talk about all of this, I'm struck by the fact that this really is this, you know, pivotal moment, and that in fact, in some ways, what we're trying to do is catch up with the energy that's already out there. I was at an award ceremony for the All-American High School Service Awards this morning that Parade Magazine featured. And there were 16 amazing high school students, and probably half of them were doing international work. So these are like 14-year-olds who are starting programs in Rwanda. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think that we have a new generation that really is conceptualizing their role as global citizens. And that part of what we're doing is just basically giving an undergirding to the infrastructure through business, through government, through NGOs. I have a couple of people that inspire me around this. One is a friend of mine from Augusta, Georgia, whose name is Duncan Moore, and he saw a segment on 60 Minutes actually a couple of years ago, and it was about malnutrition in the developing world, and especially around infants, and it talked about a new remedy that was a peanut-based product that was having a miraculous effect. And for those of you who don't know, Georgia is a peanut state, and so Duncan said, peanuts are something I know about. And so I don't know that much about what's happening in Niger and malnutrition, but he actually started moonlighting. He's a businessman, collected a group of people from around Augusta, Georgia, who had expertise in peanut production. And a couple of months ago, they shipped and delivered their first shipment of a new patented peanut-based product that they're now producing in Augusta to Niger and to other countries in Africa. So I think it just shows you, like, the nature of how we are conceptualizing service and international engagement continues to evolve and to really change. There was a platform developed in Kenya a couple of years ago that probably many of you already know about, but I just recently heard about, and I can't pronounce it, but it's something like Ushahidi, and it means testimony in Swahili. And in 2007, it became a way through mobile phones for people to basically map violence that was happening in Kenya. So a group of international volunteers, multinational volunteers, took that technology, continued to extend it, and it was used in Haiti. And literally people in the Coast Guard were using it to track and figure out where people needed help and where help was available. So we are actually seeing how the energy of citizens can solve important international problems, and we're seeing also how global it all is, how it starts in Kenya, spreads across, and then comes back to Haiti and around and around and around again. And we are seeing that through Hands-On Network. We have primarily had our work domestically. We have about 250 hands-on action centers across the country. But we're increasingly seeing our innovation and growth coming internationally. And we're now in 16 different countries internationally. Again, just to show you how some of these things are manifesting themselves, we have an expat volunteer who moved to China about 6 years ago, started Hands on Shanghai. In the last 6 years, they've grown from his one individual effort to over 10,000 volunteers, and they have 90% of their volunteers are local volunteers. They are, doing extraordinary things, partnering with corporations, and really actually becoming leaders for our larger network, sending back their ideas for innovation and projects that are happening. And we are seeing this sort of, leadership from corporations who are no longer conceptualizing their philanthropy domestically, but truly internationally. And I think, they're looking for these local NGOs, and they are also looking and creating forcing mechanisms for all of us to reconceptualize how we think about service and civic engagement. The last thing I want to just hit upon is this International Social Innovation Fund, which is kind of a hybrid of the Social Innovation Fund and the Volunteer Generation Fund, both of which were conceptualized in part of the Serve America Act. In some ways an invitation to this group to think about what could that look like. But what are the possibilities for an innovation fund that would see the next generation, the 2.0 or perhaps 3.0 of international service through technology, by building the local capacity, also recognizing that as we are building local capacity for NGOs that might be engaging international volunteers, we're also building civil society in these countries, because increasingly volunteers are working together. So I think there's really exciting possibilities, again, with the entire bill, with the social innovation set of possibilities, the bill I'm projecting and
good.
Imagining. But the platform, I think, that's here is a rich one that I think in partnership we can really develop into something that is giving us the exponential shift and change that we want to create. And then finally, I just give an example of one of our points of inspiration, which is where our first international affiliate was Hands on Manila. And I think it's the kind of example of the support that a catalytic kind of investment could make. But Hands on Manila, and again, I think it shows the global nature of how people are serving, was started by a volunteer from the Philippines who was living in Phoenix, who participated through Hands on Phoenix, who decided when she went back to Manila that this was exactly the kind of organization that she wanted to be a part of, that built it upon the Filipino principles and values of team and community, that adopted certain principles like the volunteer leader and turned them into what they use, Sherpas in Manila, who are their service leaders who they rely upon to lead others in service. They now are coming back to our conference next week in New York and reporting upon the book that they've published with volunteer stories from the Philippines, the CD that they've created, all of which are now being replicated by our domestic affiliates. And they are now engaging international volunteers in the wake of disaster and also for environmental and cultural heritage, and so have just started a hands-on vacation program. And so, again, I think the hybrid, the nexus, the confluence of these international, local engagement strategies and how they really can be transformational and spread ripples across the globe that that can change our world, that certainly can change the understanding and build more just societies, communities, and vibrant democracies. So we're thrilled to be a part of this and look forward to engaging with all of you all to bring it to fruition.
Beautifully said. Let's open it up for questions. And if you keep your questions short and your answers relatively short, we'll have more time.
Thank you very much to everyone for your comments. I actually have a question for Steve. I wanted to just kind of... I just had a question for Steve. What are kind of the next steps in terms of this proposed legislation? What's happening next, and what should we all be on the lookout for, and what can we be helping with? I think a lot of people in this room are probably representatives of different service providers or service facilitators, and what really should we be on the lookout for?
Thank you. That's an excellent question. I think I'm going to say a couple words and then ask Bridge to give us a few more words as well. First of all, I applaud your question about action, because that's what we need. And you know, I mentioned before how we have such a terrific team. The Building Bridges Coalition now has over 300 members, and we have new partners that are, you know, and the Building Bridges Coalition is just one of the conveners of the Service World legislation, like Hands-On Network, Point of Light Foundation, and others that are so important in this partnership. So, you know, number one is to make a commitment to be engaged. It's so easy to get that email that says, please forward this to your 10,000 constituents. We need to act on every single opportunity. And there's, I know we're in Brookings, and I don't want to speak too much about advocacy. That's a joke. I can speak freely. But there, you know, there's a tremendous amount of work going on in organization. Jim Swiderski is leading the advocacy working group at the Building Bridges Coalition. So I remain. The point is to get on the email list, stay engaged, because there are going to be very concrete steps that are coming up very soon.
But just
that
bridge, very quickly, Strobe Talbot convened a fantastic forum that Harris and others participated here at Brookings, that brought together the administration and other leaders to talk about policy. We brief the White House actually has been sending representatives to our meetings, just to listen and at our invitation, according to course, participate in policy development with outside groups. But we briefed the White House last week, and they want to convene the Domestic Policy Council and the National Security Council around a discussion of this plan. Also, thanks to Jim and Ann Mora Conley, going to be meeting with the State Department. Secretary Clinton and Jack Lew and others have tremendous interest in this particular issue. And this is just the beginning of a plan, and we actually really would like any of you in this room, and we'll be encouraging the 6,000 at Michelle's conference next week, to send any further ideas, edits, comments, other ideas that we haven't thought about, because this is just the beginning. And David will talk in the end about next steps in terms of how we're going to use these various action-forcing events to try to force action, just as we did with the Service Nation effort.
Can I go ahead?
Yes, please.
Hi, Bridge. My name is Doug McGuire. I work at Meridian International Center, and we were able to host 100 global leaders from around the world through a State Department program, and they participated and met with Hands-On Network people, and they were just unbelievably inspired by America. But my question is that I know from previous work at the World Bank that IBM created a toolkit for entrepreneurship, and looking at the Hands-On Network and the power of that in terms of a toolkit, I'm sure you have some of the basics of what they do, but does such a formal toolkit kind of exist for some of the people who came on our program? And then secondly, in terms of engaging companies in those countries to give the same type of commitment, can companies like IBM play a role? Are you finding that that's easy, Michelle, in terms of engaging those companies?
Wonderful question. Stan and then Michelle.
Well, I'll start off with the toolkit idea. IBM partnered with the World Bank to create a toolkit for small businesses on a worldwide basis. It's in 30 countries. It's in 17 different languages. If you're starting a business or working on your business, it's smetoolkit.org. And it's got how to do a business plan, how to do a marketing strategy, collaboration tools, and the like. We have a similar tool at IBM that my colleague Diane Melly built for IBM employees, the 100 now 50,000 employees who are regularly doing community service and volunteer work. And stay tuned, because our plan for IBM's centennial is to make a version of that toolkit available free of charge for anyone. Mm-hmm. So we're on it, and I think we can solve that part of the problem. The second part is a little tougher. How do you scale up from one, two, or three, or five companies to get larger numbers of companies to the table? And I think it is possible through the same kind of an advocacy effort that Bridge and you, so many of you are talking about from the standpoint of the United States Congress and the President and legislation. To some extent, if you got the same kind of a grassroots movement that would affect companies' decision-making, we've seen about half a dozen companies picking up now on the IBM Corporate Service Corps model, but that's too damn slow. So if there were a lot of advocacy directed at companies in individual geographies, I think you would see it, because the one thing in my experience that's a little different from the corporate sector is people are benchmark crazy. And if somebody else has done something that they're making money out of and it's successful, they want to steal it or the version of that. So I think we're going to see more of it, but we could prime the pump a little bit more.
Two more quick questions, two more quick answers, and then we're going to close.
Yang Lo-yoon, Foundation for Empowerment, formerly the World Bank. Mm-hmm. I have, first of all, as a recipient of the Praise for Service in Korea, certainly I applaud the impact of all this fiscal service and others. My question is, while you try to focus on the outcome, then certainly the receivership is very important, I guess. So the thing is how you really try to define the role of the receivers or beneficiaries in this international service, for example, and particularly in terms of the identifying the demands and demands of service they need and what kind of role they can really play in the from the identification to the completion. My second question, very quick question, is I've seen the enormous demand or commitment from the young people to be in community service or international service, maybe particularly due to the Obama's inspiration. But I'm wondering what kind of impact of this difficult economic situation makes on the their commitment at the same time in terms of funding.
Good. Wonderful question. Panelists? Steve?
Sure. First of all, thank you for the question, and I'll start with the latter
and briefly
question. Yeah, thanks, Bridge. First of all, the economic impact has been substantial. Since people are largely left to fund their own international volunteer service outside of the Peace Corps, it has had a very negative impact. So, you know, I think now more than ever, this legislation is important. And in terms of how programs are designed, you know, I could generalize and just say that in general, a international volunteer might travel overseas to do service, but the project that they're working in is generally working with a local grassroots organization. So they're working in a local community-based NGO, let's say. And the staff that are receiving them are typically local host country volunteer staff. So generally, it's a partnership where the project is designed with more local expertise than external expertise, and the volunteers are there to carry out the task set out by those that develop.
Let me just add quickly, we have to make the economic case for international volunteer service. When we were moving to pass the Kennedy Serve America Act, we almost didn't get it done because the economy went south and there weren't going to be resources. So we wrote a report called The Quiet Crisis, one that we have Great Depression levels of unemployment. So putting people, young people, into productive work and then getting skills that then when the economy improves, they can those skills be relevant to getting jobs. Second, at low cost to the taxpayer. And third, through with no new government bureaucracy, since we'll be deploying people through existing nonprofits. One other quick question, and then we're going to move to Harris and David.
Real quick, thank you, honestly, and challenge as well. I want to thank you for the focus on partnerships, because it's key. It's, the phrase partnerships on paternalism is huge. But also challenge you and really all of us to continue to focus on the multilateral aspect of it. And I think when we're talking about this in New York, when we're talking about this on Capitol Hill, it's not just Return Peace Corps volunteers in the room, it's also nonprofit leaders from overseas volunteering here, and continue to give that those stories as Michelle did and all of you did, I think really sells it in a more compelling way, maybe not for every legislator, but in a fundamental sense that this really is about international service together from all countries, working side by side across borders. So I just wanted to kind of give it a shout out for those volunteers here and for the how it's written into the Service World Policy Proposal and make sure that we're it's not just on paper, but it's also in our words when we're talking about it on the stage. So
wonderful way to end. Can we have a round of applause for the panelists?